This is Mark Steiner. Good to have you with us. We are right here on your source for cool jazz and more, WEAA 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. And every year there's a Constitution Day held at the Maryland Institute College of Art. This year's theme is Black Lives Matter, Structural Racism in the 21st Century. One of those guests, Melissa Harris Perry, will be there. She couldn't join us today, but one of the guests who can join us today on that panel is Reggie Shuford, who is the American Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania Executive Director and former Executive Director of Law and Policy at the Equal Justice Society. Reggie Shuford. Reggie, welcome to the program.
Hi, thanks for having me.
I'm glad you're here. And Furman de Brabander is with us, professor of philosophy at MICA and author of Do Guns Make Us Free, Democracy in an Armed Society, who has helped create this Constitution Day. Good to have you with us, Furman.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi. Number here is 410-319-8888. You can write to us here at talk@steinershow.org. Tweet us at Mark Steiner. So, Reggie, I'm curious. This is we talk about this issue a lot. But I'm very curious what this panel to you means and what you are and what you're bringing down to Baltimore.
I think that the panel is very timely, given all that's happening around our country, including in Baltimore. Before I was in Pennsylvania, I spent 15 years at the National ACLU in New York City, but my work then was more national, and I had the opportunity, in fact, to work with colleagues at the ACLU of Maryland on a really important and groundbreaking racial profiling case against the Maryland State Police. I'm very familiar with
it. Ah, yes, right.
Yep, I'm very familiar with Maryland and Baltimore, and I'm happy to be back. I'm honored to have been invited.
So, in the work you've done, in terms of just the legal aspects of this, you've got different parts of this panel, including the artist Titus Kaphar. And so I'm curious what changes you see afoot and how the laws may be affected and challenged that have come out of the Black Lives Matters movement. Because we're in a new set of struggles. This is different than 1968 or 1988 or 1998. So what do you think, how legally, what will the challenges be?
Well, I'm excited that the solution, right, to these problems will not just be in the courtroom. So I'm very excited that the movement for Black Lives is taking place. And I think it demands accountability from police in a way that a court system might not be able to achieve. I think it's going to require really a combination, though, of things. So that will include the sort of on-the-ground activism that is happening, utilizing quite effectively, in my opinion, online activism as well. I think policies and practices are going to have to change within police departments. And I think Black Lives Matter, that movement, is forcing that type of accountability and transparency. But I also do believe that ultimately laws are going to have to change, too. And the big challenge that I've learned in doing this work for so long is the near impossibility of proving racial discrimination under the Constitution. It's erected a really high standard of proof. And as you point out quite accurately, we're in a different time, right? We're not in the 50s and the 60s, or even the early 90s
right.
In Baltimore, we found a smoking gun evidence of racial discrimination then. But by and large, discrimination and racism are not happening sort of in that old school Bull Connor way. It's much more implicit. It's much more unconscious. It's much more structural and institutional. And so to require litigants to satisfy that very high burden of proof, which is nearly impossible, is to deny people their day in court. And so there needs to be some change kind of in that standard. And I think litigants and advocates are going to have to try to force that along. It won't be easy necessarily, but I think it's essential again, aided by the other types of activism that are taking place currently, too, beyond the courtroom.
No. I'm going to push that point a little bit, Reggie, with you. But Furman, talk about the history of this Constitution Day and just give people a sense of what.
Sure. Well, Mark, I didn't create it, but I did take it over at the college about, I think this is the 10th year now. Well, actually, I think I've done the last eight.
Right.
The Constitution Day came about, I think it was Senator Robert Byrd from West Virginia, during the early days of the war on terror, said that universities need to recognize Constitution Day and cherish their constitutional rights, and so they need to, you know, do things and have activities to highlight the constitutional issues. And so every year for the past 10 years, we have at MICA done that. This is our premier political event, which is, you know, primarily political, I should say, and we have devoted it to other topics in the past, such as marriage as a civil right, freedom of assembly, surveillance. That was our topic last year, and Daniel Ellsberg was part of the panel. We naturally decided, and this was before the unrest that happened in Baltimore, we decided to devote our panel this year to the topic of institutional and structural racism that Reggie was just talking about. We decided that after thinking, you know, and looking at what happened in Ferguson and Staten Island, we decided this back in the winter, and then, of course, what happened in Baltimore in May made this all the more urgent. And so we are very pleased that this is the hot-button issue for this year's panel.
And coming back to some of these ideas, Reggie, I think that you said something that made me think about the history of the civil rights movement, what happened in the 50s and 60s, and what's happening today in this century of 2015, that things were built in many ways around laws and around the court. But I think that you have a strong point here when you think of this movement today as, let me start here, that's almost extra judicial. You know what I'm saying?
I do. I totally know what you said, and I'm grateful for that. I mean, I've been in this battle for a long time as a litigator, and I know that it can be really frustrating when people believe themselves to have been victimized by racism and discrimination, but to really ultimately have no effective remedy in the courts because of the way that our laws and the Constitution have been interpreted. And so for people to say enough is enough, we want change, we want it now, and we may not use the courts to achieve that change, I think is a great thing.
Because some people would even argue, I guess, in some ways, I'll just throw this out and see what you think, that the battle just around laws and the battle in the courts, which are really important. I'm not diminishing the importance of those battles. But those battles, in some ways, the organizing that has to change society and to push for major changes can get lost in that legal battle. Do you know what I mean?
I thought you were going to say it's a precursor to change.
But
to
no, change both. It's both are true, I think.
Right. I think so too. And I think for me, most importantly, it is the fact that if we were to wait, right, for the laws to change, we probably have a longer time to wait.
Amen
and
to
I
that.
Think
that's
what's
right.
What's happening now on the ground demands change now. So if it's not necessarily a change in the laws per se, it's a change in police accountability. And police practices and transparency and so on and so forth, which really, frankly, can have meaningful impact on the lives of people in the community, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, you have police departments that you're interacting with on a regular basis, and they are bound by certain policies. They're bound by the law, too, of course, but they're certainly bound by the policies and practices of their police department. And when those things are changed to reflect a more healthy and respectful and legal, right, approach to interacting with the citizens, that's a good thing. And so I think really all of it is necessary, change in laws, change in policies, change in practices. But I don't think one needs to I know you're not saying this, but we certainly don't need to wait till laws are changed before rights are achieved.
No, I didn't mean to emphasize that there's anything wrong with the legal battle, because I think that's critical to change. We'd be not moving anything if that wasn't if we weren't kind of fighting to change the laws and always have to fight the courts. But it has to be coupled with organizing, which I can see happening now, which I think is kind of a very powerful, explosive moment in our history. You know,
it's great.
So and I'm curious how you put this panel together with Melissa Harris Perry and Titus Kaphar, and why you chose this three.
You're asking me?
No, I'm sorry. I was asking Fremen.
Sure. Well, you know, we always like to have panelists who come at the issue in question from a different background. And Reggie, being a lawyer, of course, we've gotten a taste of his perspective and expertise. Melissa, a public personality, also an academic and an author. And Titus, who is a very exciting artist. We do typically involve an artist on the panel because, you know, we want to speak to the student population here at MICA. Now, you know, this event is open to the public, but, you know, the students, of course, form a big portion of the audience, and so we like to have an artist in the panel that speaks to them and lets them know, you know, what you can do, and you know, in your work, and how you can highlight, for example, the issue of racial injustice and structural racism. What, you know, how you can approach in your work, but also how you can do it through activism. And I just think that the point that, you know, you and Reggie were making, this that this is an extrajudicial movement, is very powerful to bring to, you know, our student population here at MICA, because, you know, Mark, we're very close to where the epicenter of the unrest was. You know, we're only a few blocks away, and when this was going on in the spring, a lot of the students were wondering, what can we do? What is there to do? What can we do? And I'm excited for Reggie to come and meet with them and tell them what they can do.
Yeah, I think, what are you going to tell them, Reggie?
But I think that's a really good point that I like to lift up as well, right? It's like, so you don't have to have a law degree, right?
No.
To make change in your world, right? To make change in your community. And that is a really powerful thing. And to the extent that this activism is occurring because folks are fed up, and understandably so, I think perhaps that is what is going to, in fact, push change and make it possible. So there's a lot I'll tell them, and I don't want to give it all away right now, but there are many, many ways that they can get involved and hold their communities, agencies, including police departments, accountable. And they can do it in a way that is empowering, right, to them and their communities. And so I'll share some of those things tomorrow.
I'm just curious one thing. I know that you were deeply involved in a lot of these cases around the country and around the deadly force report around Philly's cops, poor training.
Mm-hmm.
And I was reading about that this morning that you were involved with, and I, you know, I wonder how you think, given that a lot of what we're seeing now, the explosions, the explosiveness of what we're seeing in America now, in part is about the numbers of police interactions with black communities and communities of color, and the violence that takes place from police towards people of color, especially black people in this country. And people talk about training, which is why I raised the Philly issue. Training is a piece of it, but I think there's a real hard one to put our hands around, which is that racism is, as we talked about early in the program when we talked to Ta-Nehisi Coates, and that is kind of that even Daniel Moynihan said back in '65 is in the blood of this country, is in the veins of America, and is deeply embedded in our police departments, whether we want to admit it or not. Not that every policeman is a horrid racist. I'm not saying that, but the level of racism in those departments is deep, and that's beyond training in some ways. Maybe I'm wrong.
I don't know that it's beyond training, but I think it's a good distinction between individual kind of bias and institutional bias, right? And so you have perfectly good cops who are not biased in any way, working in departments that do promote targeting people of color.
Mm-hmm.
And so I do think those kind of organizational conversations are important, and I think training has to be a part of that solution. And it may not solve everything, but I think it can be really, really helpful, right? Because I think you first have to name and identify what the problem is.
Yeah.
And you have to call it out for what it is. And you've got to take it seriously. And I think training, for example, training on implicit bias, right? I mean, I think one of the things that's so powerful about that social science and that concept is that, you know, we all suffer from it. I mean, I'm not in a position to point a finger at you and call you
right.
a biased person, because we all suffer from implicit bias. It's what it means to be human. It's what it means to live and be socialized in this country. But there have been studies that suggest that when you point that out and train people about implicit bias and say, you know, we're not pointing our finger at you, but we're all subject to this, then there have been changes have been possible. So, no, I do think training is really, really important. So long as it's done well and with integrity, as opposed to grudgingly and doing it just to check it off and say that you did it.
Let me get a quick call in here before we have to take a break. Lily on line one, welcome.
Yeah, I wanted to know, wasn't it micro students not too long ago, it was either during the riots, after, or just before, who put some racially inflammatory statements, I believe, on somewhere in the campus? Wasn't that micro students that did that?
It was a micro, Furman can speak to it, but there was a micro student who did that, and then a huge community meeting was set up at micro with hundreds of students in attendance. Furman?
Yes, no, there was. There was a big outcry. There was a racially insensitive remarks were scrawled on an elevator in one of the dormitories, I believe, and no one took responsibility for it, as far as I know, and there was a tremendous community response spearheaded by our new president, Sammy Hoy, organized with the Black Students Union to discuss this and to get, you know, to discuss the simmering animosity, if there were, or any kind of resentments on campus or any kind of tensions. No, we tried to head that off beforehand, as far as I can tell.
No, it was what was done there, I thought, was magnificent, the way the community meeting was called. And I talked to a number of people at MICA who were involved in that, including Paul Rucker. So I think that...
No, and it was amazing the way that happened, and then shortly thereafter, you know, the riots were happening right down the street on North Avenue. So that's really made, you know, racial tensions a key topic on campus this year and going forward.
This year's Constitution Day at the Maryland Institute College of Art, Black Lives Matter, Structural Racism in the 21st Century America, will take place Thursday night, tomorrow night, September 17th, from 7 to 9 p.m. at Micah's Brown Center in the Falvey Hall, located at 1301 West Mount Royal Avenue. The panelists include MSNBC's television host, Melissa Harris-Perry, Maryland Civil Liberties Union of Pennsylvania Executive Director, who joins us here, Reggie Shuford, and artist Titus Kapfer. More information and information about how to watch the symposium via live stream is at mica.edu/Black Lives Matter. And Reggie Shuford and Furman DeBray-Brander, thank you both so much for taking your time today.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you.
Good luck tomorrow night. Have a great event. Thanks. We're going to take a very brief break, and when we come back, we'll hear what's in this week's City Papers anticipated Best of Baltimore issue, which is on the stands today. We'll be right back.